executed.
Right. Okay.
That failed. Now they come out clean and they attack General Qasem Soleimani and take him out. Why now? See, one thing I want every one of us to understand is that it is not about executing a person, let it be a president of a country or chief of staff or, you know, any big higher up positions. It is doable to take them out, to murder them, to assassinate them. But the calculation there is that whether we are going to be able to handle the deterrence.
The blowback.
This calculation, the blowback, the retaliation, the response. This calculation, like for instance, there are people who can probably take out, I don't know, Trump, right? The question is, you know, even China can do that, right? And America can do it to Chinese, you know, whatever their head of the state is. The question is whether we are going to be able to, at this stage, take the retaliation and take this deterrence that is going to, the response that is going to come. Now, America's calculation, right, if this formula is clear, the America, you know, America's calculation was that now we have planted enough sectarian seeds in Iraq. The Sunnis and Shias are going to fight with each other. You know, the religious scholars are going to fight. The public is going to fight. The government is going to fight. There's going to be civil war. You know, it's all internally, they're not going to be united. They're all, you know, split up.
Okay.
That's what America's calculation was.
Especially with the protests that were happening.
Correct. And, you know, just a few days before this, you know, American embassy gets attacked and, you know, there's a blowback and then these people, you know, go through a turmoil. Now, on Iran's side, they were thinking that we have, through our sanctions, snubbed the nation, the Iranian nation so much,
their
back is broken. So now if we take out General Qasem Soleimani,
they won't do anything.
They are just going to, you know, kneel down in front of us. They're going to be, you know, their spirits are going to be just, you know, completely gone. That was America's calculation.
And it was a completely mistaken calculation.
And it backfired. Right?
To the point where they got missiles hit at them.
Exactly. Now, you know, they never thought in last 70 years, 80 years, nobody has been able to attack America's base in the world.
Nobody.
Really? Nobody.
Yeah, nobody.
There was no attack on America. No country, not even one country throughout the world was able to do that. Okay? Now, we look at it today. Even today, no other country has the courage or audacity to go ahead and attack America's base no matter what.
Nope.
Iran did it. Iran attacked America's Ayn al-Assad base, right? This military base, one of the most expensive bases of America, with their fighter jets, with their drones, with their, you know, military equipment and everything in there, they attacked them. And not just one missile. It was a rain of missiles from Iran to Iraq. It was not even from within Iraq, right? From Iran to Iraq. They made it clear that we are the ones who are going to respond. And as the leader of the Islamic Ummah said, that it was just a slap. Mm. It's not even that severe revenge that the leader has talked about. What is that severe revenge? One of the very basic tenets of that severe revenge is the evacuation of American troops and forces from this entire region, not just Iraq. Not just one country or two countries, from this entire region. And this is what the dream of General Qasem Soleimani was. This is what he was building up towards. And this is why he was carried out. As soon as these troops are wound up from here, they know that Israel is vulnerable.
Mm. They're just going to pack their bags and leave.
Exactly. They wouldn't have to be even attacked. They know that they would be exposed. They would not be able to contain any of the pressure from their neighbors even, right? So this is the entire thing. This is why they got attacked. They had Qasem Soleimani, General Qasem Soleimani attacked now. And
because of their miscalculation.
Right.
Dear listeners, we hope that you enjoyed the show today. If you do have any questions or queries or you want to take a look at any of our other content, you can visit pasttoday.com. From myself, from Sayyid Mahdi, and from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.com. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least 7 people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples, again uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. 2 died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened 2 brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities, Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas. The most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath in it and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic, and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up, and I'll be moaning and crying, my cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified, the sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls look like they turn into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I go back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me out of limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, And then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name. And it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks, 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's why they did it. That's why they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted. So they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again. Must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesia, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971, and I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing a person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. This is, I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things to go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. You don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where the spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. Yeah. They tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat. You know. So.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that looked like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont-Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot, it had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blocked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past and misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, internal and external purity. Purity and cleanliness have two dimensions, internal and external. Internal purity and cleanliness refers to the emptying or cleaning the self of all pride that results from the love of the self and the world. Thus, cleanliness and purity are linked with being an Allah-fearing person. The external dimension of purity and cleanliness is expressed in physical hygiene. But in the Islamic outlook, the external and internal are not separated. This is something important for all of us to get. Faith and action are also inseparable, and therefore to clean and purify oneself is faith in action. Purity and cleanliness are a religious category, like studying and learning more about religion and truth. Idolaters are correspondingly identified in the prophetic experience with dirt and impurity, both internally and externally. Brothers and sisters, it's important for us to know and understand and realize that our internal purity is not different and not separable from our external purity. They both go hand in hand. Sometimes we see people, they're so concerned and focused about the fiqhi ahkam to just maintain their apparent purity and apparent cleanliness. It is really good. And it is desired, but this is not where it ends. It is connected with your internal purity. So when you do your physical purity and cleanliness, you should be, if not more, then at least equally concerned about the internal purity of yourself. And this is the message of today's show. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we're talking about the two forms of impurity, internal and external purity. Abstaining from insulting and hurting others lead to a sound heart and is the guide to success in this life and the hereafter. A person with a purified heart will definitely have good intentions, deeds, tongue, and other senses alike. So see how your internal purity, as a matter of fact, manifests in your physical purity, in your physical decency. Islam has placed great emphasis on purifying the hearts. As a hadith by Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam concerning the Day of Judgment says, "Verily Allah does not look to your faces and your wealth, but He looks to your heart and your deeds." Those with sound hearts are also the best people in this world. When the Prophet was once asked, "Which of the people is best?" he replied, "Everyone who is pure of heart and sincere in speech." When they asked him what is meant by a pure heart, the Prophet replied, "It is the heart that is pious and pure, with no sin, injustice, rancor, or envy in it." So brothers and sisters, like we said, physical purity and cleanliness is of utmost importance, but more important is the internal purity, the purity of your heart, the purity of your intentions, the purity of your thoughts. And once we achieve that, we start to see it reflect in our actions. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a pleasure and honor to have a share of a few moments of your day as we reflect upon the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in the form of everyday stories regarding great personalities and figures, anecdotes, analogies. Because at the end of the day, we do what we can in order to find a glimpse of the light of truth in our lives. The story we're going to be discussing today is very similar to that of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam, which we've talked about on our show, I think, on several occasions. So let's listen to the story real quick, and we'll see how this story is similar to that of the Prophet of God.
In the name of Allah, dear friends, so welcome to this program, Lantern. Today's story is entitled Feeling Pleased with Whatever Pleases Allah. One of the students of Sheikh Behjat, the great scholar, says, "One day I went to the house of Sheikh Behjat a few minutes before the start of the class, because often the Sheikh used to attend the classroom and he would narrate a story or a tradition or a moral lesson till all the students attend. Luckily, as I entered, he came to the room early and said this to me after the greeting and the salutation. In the city of Najaf, a handsome Iranian youth was with us from the people of Hamadan, and he was famous for being neat and physically well-formed. One day, this youth became paralyzed to the extent he could not walk except after leaning on a cane. I tried not to meet him due to his particular condition. Therefore, I used to avoid meeting him so I would not add one more grief to his griefs. One day, I got out of the alley and saw him standing in the street, so I had no choice except to meet him. Without contemplating, I asked him, 'How do you feel?' But I was upset with having said so and kept saying this to myself, 'What empty talk is this? Do you not see in what condition he is?' But contrary to my expectation, when he opened his mouth to answer my question, his speech was like cool water with which he put out what I had felt inside. He kept praising and thanking Allah with a spirit filled with activity and pleasure, as if he was drowned in blessings of Allah, the praise and the most exalted one. I felt relieved and my grief departed from me."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
In the story of this man that we heard about, he was known for his appealing appearance, but he was crippled and he was paralyzed. The same was the story of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam, if you guys remember. He was known for being like above blessed, especially blessed, whether it was about having many good children, whether it was regarding his wealth, his harvest, his crops, his livestock, you know, him being loved by his community and the tribe that he lived in, and shoop, Allah takes all of that away from him. And Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam is still grateful. The point of that, however, isn't that Allah is going to give you a blessing and then take it away from you. Because obviously, Allah is not a child with an ant farm. He's not a bully. Na'udhu billah. He wants us to, number one, be happy. He genuinely wants us to be happy, because unless we are happy, we won't be able to engage in other productive activities in our life, whether it's acts of worship, whether it's contributing to the society we're living in, whether it's academic activities and growth. Unless we're happy, and by happiness I don't mean that euphoric buzz of adrenaline in our body, the same feeling I get after watching a nice movie or having really good chocolate with chai. By happiness, I mean that state of being and mind where I'm elevated, that state of being and mind where I feel a constant flow of energy within myself. I'm motivated, I'm driven, I have an inner encouragement and strive to do better, to be better, to do good things. That's the kind of happiness Allah wants for us. And depending on our capacity and the situation that we're in, he lets us experiment with different occasions and events in order to find that level of happiness within us. So when it comes to trials and tests, Allah puts us again in scenarios that elevate that sense of drive within us. And also, like we said, Allah wants us to grow. So, and that's the main objective. It is upon us to be able to find that state of happiness and inner contentment and strive in every situation that Allah puts us in. The other thing about putting us through tests that we hate, like the Quran says, "Asa an takrahu shay'an wa huwa khayrun lakum." Often you hate something, but it's actually good for you. I'm not going to bring in the whole bitter medicine analogy thing. But I am going to say that he puts us through those tests so we can realize one thing. There's a hadith from one of the infallibles, alayhim salawatullah wassalam, that says one of the levels of giving thanks to Allah is to realize that a blessing is from God directly without considering any of the mediums. Sometimes we get so involved in these mediums, in these middle factors, these middle men, when we receive a blessing, that we forget entirely that it was Allah who is responsible for this bounty that has been bestowed upon us. Like, when it comes to beauty, we are so quick to say, well, good genes, you know, my mom was pretty and my dad was handsome and, you know, they got married and the result is a beautiful child. Well, I could have seriously picked up the worst genes. I mean, no one's perfect. I could have picked up the worst genes in both parents, but Allah decided to bless me or her or him or whoever with the best of each world. That within itself is a test, and I have to recognize that. I'm not saying that I have to be in a constant state of anxiety that, oh my God, this blessing has been given to me. When is it going to be taken away? But I must be in a constant state of awareness. I must be on the edge of my seat in the sense that I do not neglect this blessing that Allah has given to me. I do not neglect the source of this blessing. I do not misuse this blessing. I must constantly be cautious, aware, and careful that I don't waste this blessing. And wasting this blessing could mean a lot of things. It could mean not giving enough gratitude for it, not expressing enough gratitude for it, or using it in a way that it was not meant to be used, or not using it at all.
That's all the time that we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
The Israeli regime has always prided itself on being the home of the latest cyber technology, boasting about its capabilities in both aggressive and defensive cyber warfare. However, it seems that the regime has counted its eggs a little too early, as a sophisticated hack has shown the real side of Israeli cybersecurity. The hack, which appears to have taken place over a period of months, appears to be from a source known as Pay to Key, with the hackers deploying a form of highly sophisticated ransomware designed to extract high quantities of information from its target, as well as demanding £100,000 in Bitcoin to stop leaks going public. It seems that the hack targeted a cybersecurity company by the name of Portnox which itself appears to be a major provider of cybersecurity to multiple Israeli regime offices, including the Israeli aerospace industry, El Al, Bezak, and Clalit Healthcare, many of which have direct links to the Israeli regime and defense systems. Evidence also suggests that much of the information which is threatening to be leaked contains secret information about various Israeli defense networks and companies, which, although not apparent to what exact details are involved, could see highly classified and sensitive Israeli secrets flooded into the public domain. A spokesman for another Israeli cybersecurity company, Clear Sky, announced that the damage done by the hackers has caused significant damage to the Israeli regime and has pointed the finger of blame at Iran as the origin of the attack, raising the question as to just what right does Israel have to put the onus on Iran after the acts the Israeli regime has committed on the country, including, of course, the famous Stuxnet bug, which targeted Iran's peaceful civilian nuclear program.
Even if Iranians were responsible for this latest cyber attack, and indeed the Israeli press has not ascertained culpability yet, and so it said clearly that it can't determine whether or not Iranians were involved, but even if Iranians were involved in this latest cyber attack, Israel would be in no position to complain about it, having taken the cyber gloves off, if you will, by initiating cyber war directly against Iran in 2009 and 10 with the Stuxnet sabotage cyber campaign. This was a campaign of the United States and Israel under the code name Operation Olympic Games, which was designed to destroy elements of Iran's civilian nuclear energy program.
The finger of blame has been pointed at Iran yet again, this time by the Israeli regime. Yet just earlier this month, the US also pointed towards Iran for a series of hacks that were alleged to have breached US voting procedures and officials, something that Iran denied as nonsense. But it seems that Israel is no stranger to cyber attacks themselves, with others predating the Pay2Key attack. Earlier this year, more than 1,000 Israeli websites were hacked, with images of Tel Aviv in flames, warning Israel that the countdown to destruction had begun, with the Israeli building up a host of enemies due to its hostile actions around the world, from the displacement of people in Palestine to the participation of acts of state-sponsored terrorism. Is it any wonder that Tel Aviv is on the radar of multiple hackers from unknown locations? With such attacks proving that the Israeli regime is both ill-equipped to deal with attacks and too hasty in claiming to be a world leader in security-related issues, has the regime then lost its place at the top of the charts when it comes to cyber and electronic technology?
I believe that this latest hack demonstrates that truly all systems are vulnerable to potential cyber attack. And considering the fact that Israel prides itself so much on its high technology and its cybersecurity, this just proves that even the Israeli cybersecurity can be broken. And so this raises the question, why play with fire, especially when fire will be fought with fire?
There's no doubt that the hack is, and may further yet to prove, a huge embarrassment for the Israeli regime, in particular as the details of the information obtained is yet to be revealed by the hackers, and is similar in nature to a recent hack on US bodies, which the US alleged originated from Russia. Yet with allegations flying around, the priority now for the Israeli regime is to hope that the information obtained does not fall into the public domain and further shame the regime that appears to have no shame.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to surge across the world, many countries have started mass vaccinations in an effort to bring the virus under control. From Europe to Latin America, many nations have imported vaccines in large quantities to help their people get rid of the highly infectious disease. Iran, however, has managed to come up with its own domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine. The country has now begun testing the inoculation on humans after successfully completing the initial steps, including tests on animals and obtaining necessary approvals. The human trial of the vaccine was initiated at the headquarters of executing the order of Imam Khomeini in the capital Tehran on Tuesday. A total of 56 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first stage. The vaccine, Coviran Barakat, is named after the pharmaceutical group behind its development. The achievement comes as Iranian authorities have been critical of the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy a vaccine from abroad. Many believe the Iranian-made vaccine proves the country's enhanced capabilities despite U.S. sanctions.
Necessity is the mother of invention, they say, and the Iranian people needed a vaccine. The U.S. Maximum pressure campaign denied them access to the vaccines. And so the Iranian people, their scientists, their government, had to go the extra mile to be resilient and develop their own domestic vaccine. It's a remarkable achievement, but it's the kind of thing that is an unintended consequence of campaigns of maximum pressure and hybrid warfare against countries. People learn to be self-sufficient, to be reliant, and they make new alliances with other countries in the military, economic, and political spheres, and that's exactly what Iran has done.
On Saturday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again lashed out at Washington, saying its wicked activities have caused trouble for Tehran to acquire vaccines. Earlier this month, the head of Iran's central bank also slammed the U.S. administration for its sanctions, which he said have been hampering efforts to purchase the inoculation. Abdel Nasser Hemmati said Iran is prepared to purchase the vaccine through the World Health Organization, but it is unable to transfer the required money due to what he called inhumane U.S. sanctions. Hemmati, however, expressed hope that the vaccine-related transactions will be facilitated through other channels. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. Since then, American officials have targeted every Iranian sector with sanctions ever enforced against any nation. The U.S. economic pressure has prompted Iranian officials to take a tactical step against such measures. Earlier this month, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, urged officials to focus on neutralizing the sanctions apart from securing their removal. The leader even cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that U.S. hostilities toward Iran will not end once President Trump leaves office. But from the medical field to the military complex, technology, and a whole host of other fields, Iran has advanced its know-how domestically thanks to the U.S. maximum pressure campaign and sanctions.
Clearly, the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure has not succeeded in overturning the government of the Islamic Republic, and in fact has made it stronger and more resilient. And an unintended consequence of all of this maximum pressure campaign has been to force Iran and other countries under the thumb of the U.S. to become more self-reliant and to seek other trading arrangements, other military arrangements, other political alliances. And the end result is that the U.S. empire is now declining, and it will continue to decline at an ever-accelerating pace.
But the U.S. measures are not bound to sanctions alone. Washington and its allies, namely Israel, have a long history of using other evil tactics to prevent Tehran from its advancements. That includes the assassination of Iranian scientists, with Mohsen Fakhrizadeh being the latest victim of U.S. and Israeli plots. Fakhrizadeh is not the only Iranian scientist assassinated by the American and Israeli agents, and probably will not be the last one.
The U.S. and many of the G20 countries engage in regimes of economic sanctions and programs of hybrid warfare against a number of countries with the point of bringing these countries under their control. The U.S. is an empire, and it uses campaigns of hybrid warfare, which included, for example, the targeted assassinations of General Soleimani and the nuclear scientist, Dr. Fakhrizadeh. Includes economic sanctions. It includes